The Extra Pack of Peanuts Travel Podcast, Episode 22. The cable car in San Francisco is the only National Historic Monument in the world that moves. I'll show you Paris in the morning. I'll show you London afternoon. If you feel your Dublin heart is burning, yeah, well, you don't. Hey guys, welcome to another edition of the Extra Pack of Peanuts Travel Podcast. And without giving too much away, I want to tell you that we've got an awesome show lined up for you today with Fred Parada. And me and Fred are going to talk about an expert pro traveling tip that's going to make your travels infinitely better. We're also going to be talking a lot about entrepreneurship and the struggles that Fred has in creating his own business. So if you're someone who wants to start a business or you have a business, a service, or a product, we're going to be discussing all our successes and failures and what we did to create our own businesses. So if you're interested in that, I highly suggest you listen to this podcast. It's some invaluable advice there. Fred is also graciously going to offer Extra Pack of Peanuts Travel Podcast listeners a discount code for his amazing travel product at the end of the show, so you'll want to stay tuned in for that. Lastly, if you don't have a copy of The Ultimate Guide to Frequent Flyer Miles and you want to learn more about frequent flyer miles and how to use them to travel around the world for free, we are offering a free 15-minute consultation for anyone who goes and gets a business or first-class package of that product up until Christmas. So you can find that by extrapackofpeanuts.com/ultimate guide. All right, let's get on the show because I know you guys are going to love it. Hello, travel nerds, and welcome to the Extra Pack of Peanuts Travel Podcast, the show that teaches you how to travel more while spending less. I'm Trav, the creator of Extra Pack of Peanuts, and with me today is fellow Pennsylvanian, world traveler, entrepreneur, and a man who believes that all travel can be done without a checked bag, Fred Parada, founder of Tortuga Backpacks. Fred, thanks so much for coming on the show and welcome.
Of course, and thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I'm super excited to have you on the show today because both of us share two common loves, entrepreneurship and travel, and both of us are constantly looking for ways to merge those two together to give the world a better travel experience. And one of the ways you're doing that is through your company, Tortuga Backpacks. So if you wouldn't mind, give us a little bit of the scoop. What is Tortuga Backpacks? What do you guys do?
Yeah, it's nice to be able to say that traveling is your job, right?
Exactly.
Pretty good deal. So our company, Tortuga Backpacks, we make a carry-on sized travel backpack. Basically, the kind of quick story behind it, in 2009, my co-founder Jeremy and I went on a backpacking trip to Eastern Europe. And we knew we wanted backpacks for the trip, and we just couldn't find the right luggage. And so eventually we figured out what we needed was kind of a hybrid of a backpack and a suitcase. So we kind of put that together into its own sort of product and designed it for people who travel around the world, travel frequently within the US or within their home country. And I've been doing that we've been selling for about 2 years now.
Awesome. So Tortuga was built out of your own personal experience then?
Exactly. One of those classic scratching your own itch kind of things. We were going on this trip for a couple weeks and we're going to be going between different cities. So, you know, we thought we wanted backpacks. We knew that the suitcase would be kind of clunky to be dragging around, you know, hostels, trains, the whole thing. But all of the bags we looked at and, you know, I spent hours researching online. I went to the REI and the North Face store until they were sick of me. And, you know, I just couldn't kind of pick the right one. I couldn't figure out what I really wanted and what would be ideal. This was also kind of my first extended traveling. So, had that problem and then eventually figured out that all of the existing bags weren't really ideal for travel. So we needed something new.
Yeah, and that's awesome. And we're going to talk about entrepreneurship and how you grew the company a little later in the show. So if you guys are interested in that, definitely stick through because Fred's got some really good experiences and some knowledge with that. But I love the idea that your product is built out of a need that is on your own experiences. And I think that is where the best products usually come from. You try to do something and you think, why isn't this here? And all of a sudden, you know, you have, like you said, scratching your own itch, you have the desire to create something new. And I'm 100% on board with your idea that travel should be done without a check bag. So listeners of this show and readers of the Extra Pack of Peanuts site know that I'm constantly championing the idea of traveling with just a carry-on. So in your, and obviously you are too, you've created a backpack, a product, a company around that. So in your mind, what are the biggest advantages to traveling with just a backpack or even just without checking a bag, even if it's carry-on, whether it's a backpack or a rolling thing? We'll kind of discuss the pros and cons of each later, but why not check a bag? What are the advantages?
I feel like there's such a long list of reasons. You know, one of the biggest things, just look at all of the trends within the airline industry, right? They're taking away all of your space. They're charging more and more for checking a bag. You know, there's even talk about checking or charging for carry-on bags eventually. You know, that seems like something some of the budget airlines may do. If you look at the trends within the airline industry, you can see that they're clearly not your friends. They Right. are very large businesses, and unfortunately, a lot of them don't really make a lot of money profit-wise. So they're always looking for ways to kind of squeeze a few more dollars out of you. So that's the first one. If you look at all the trends within the airline industry, carrying on your bag is pretty much your only choice.
Right. More baggage equals more money you spend.
Exactly. Usually $25 a flight, so $50 round trip. If you're doing multiple legs, that adds up pretty quickly. And then the other side of it is just how it changes how you travel. The less you have with you, it's also mental baggage. You know, it's not just physical. So when you're not lugging around multiple giant suitcases and dragging all these things around, you can improvise on your travels. You can change where you're going. You can run here, run there. Where there's an opportunity, you can follow it because you just have some light bag on your back that you hardly even notice, you know, as you're running around between events or to a different city.
Yeah, I agree. When you bring a lot of bags, you're tied to that, right? I mean, it's more of a, we're going to go here for a week. We're going to settle in the hotel. We're going to unpack our bags. You make it more or less like your home. And that is fine if that is the only travel you're going to be doing and you're going to be staying in a resort, what have you, for the whole time. But most people, and a lot of people listening to this show, do want to see more than just going to the resort, you know, type thing. And I do think that's a great point that you're not beholden to anything. You know, an opportunity comes up and you're like, let's grab our bag and go, and you're not lugging three bags behind you everywhere.
Exactly. Someone comes up to you and there's something cool going on, but you got to catch the train in 10 minutes. It's not a problem. You know, you grab your duffel bag, your backpack, whatever in one hand, and out the door you go. You're not spending half an hour packing everything up.
Right. And I'm sure a lot of the feedback you get from people, because I am a proponent of this traveling with just a carry-on. So, you know, I'm not going to poke holes in your argument, but I'm sure there's a lot of people that say it's just not possible for them to do it. Like, there's no way I could just have a carry-on. I always bring two heavy checked bags, you know, all this stuff. What are the most common excuses you hear about why people can't travel with one backpack, and kind of what are the responses or rebuttals to that?
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, it's a mental hurdle. You know, they're used to packing for however long they're traveling in a bag of a certain size. So that's how much stuff they bring for every subsequent trip. You know, they can't kind of start over and take it and build up their luggage from scratch. But sometimes that's what you need to do. You know, a lot of people, the reason most people bring too much stuff is because they're preparing for everything that could happen. Right. Whereas what you really need are the absolute basics to get you through a few days, maybe up to a week, even if you're traveling for months at a time. And then from there, most of the other stuff, the occasion will never come up where you actually need it. And if it does, wherever you're at, you can just go buy it.
Right.
You know, if you are randomly invited to a black tie dinner, you can just go rent a cheap tuxedo wherever you're at. They'll have it. In many cases, it'll be cheaper than wherever you're from.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Kind of the motto that I take on is no matter how long your trip is, plan for 1 week. Because if you're going away for 5 months, let's say, on a huge epic journey, you know, plan for 1 week. How many clothes are you going to wear? Like, you're going to bring 5 months of clothes with you. Why would you do that? Plan for a week. Anywhere you're going has a washer, a dryer, anything like that. So you don't really need more than a week's worth of clothes. I think if a lot of people actually sat down and looked at it, they probably only wear a week's worth of clothes at home as well, you know, other than, like you said, those special occasions. Everyone has their go-to things that they wear. So why are you packing, you know, those pair of shoes that you haven't worn in 6 months at home? Why are you packing them in your bag?
Exactly. Bring the, you know, 10, 20% of your closet that you actually wear all the time, because, you know, then you'll be comfortable, you'll like what you're wearing, you'll feel good about yourself, and you don't have to worry about that kind of stuff instead of lugging around everything. You know, I bring the jeans that I wear basically every day and a bunch of different shirts to wear with it, and off you go.
Yeah, and I think you also made a good point that anywhere you are, for the most part, unless you're so off the beaten path that it probably doesn't matter, you're not going to bring a lot of luggage anyway because you couldn't even get it there. Anywhere you go is going to have a store. And, you know, like you said, you need a your pant rip, you need a new pair of pants, go out and get a new pair of pants or something like that, or a tuxedo, any type of crazy thing that comes up.
You're in the middle of the jungle, who cares what you look like, right?
Right. Yeah,
or
you're not
smell like, maybe.
Yeah, you're not wheeling your two checked bags into the middle of the jungle anyway. So
exactly.
What are then some of the items that people most commonly overpack? Because we're talking about, I believe your backpack is 44 liters, which, if people don't know, you know, how would you put that in terms of a regular school backpack that people might be used to?
Yeah, I would say the best way to compare it is it's exactly carry-on size, exactly the maximum dimensions. So whenever you've flown and you see the little cages next to the boarding gate for your airline, where they can put your luggage in to check to make sure it's the right size, it's exactly that size. So those differ a little bit between airlines, but for the most part, that's the pretty common dimension.
Yeah, and I mean, to put it in perspective for people, I have like a regular North Face backpack, and I think it's about 28 liters. So this would be, you know, about 50% bigger than that. And I think the cool thing about the Tortuga backpack, and you can expound on this, is that the size doesn't always... what I found is that something could be 44 liters and something else could be 44 liters, and something, for whatever reason, a lot more stuff fits in the one bag than the other. And that's kind of what you're going for with Tortuga, right?
Exactly. One site that really kind of touches on that, if you've ever visited, is onebag.com. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, I am. Yep.
I would definitely tell everyone to check that site out. But it's run by a guy named Doug Diamond, and he is pretty much the master of one bag travel. His site is a very awesome resource outlining everything you might want to bring, why you should choose these products over these ones. It's great. He's been around forever. He's a speaker on this kind of stuff too. And one of the things he talks about is, when choosing a bag, to find something that's rectilinear, which sounds very complicated, but basically means that whatever those dimensions are, it's as close to perfectly rectangular or perfectly square as possible. So the more a bag kind of tapers or is rounded, you're giving up space. So imagine those, the typical carry-on limits are 22 inches by 14 by 9. So if you imagine that space as kind of a perfect rectangle, that gives you the most packing space. But right. Then you could also have those dimensions and let's say the bag is more rounded or kind of a hemisphere shape. Then you're giving away, you know, a third or half of the space that you could have.
Yeah, and I think that differentiates Tortuga backpacks from most of the packs that people see out there on backpackers. They are, you know, either cylindrical or they're, you know, rounded at the top and things like that. And I think, yeah, yep. You hit on it. I mean, it's a pretty simple concept. You know, if you're as close to that dimension as possible using all the space, 44 liters is going to be more, and there's going to be ways to get stuff in that's going to fit better than if it's a different shape. So what are some of the things then that people, like we said, people do commonly overpack? Where can they cut corners in their packing? Because you have a great resource on your site that we're going to link to, but you have all these tips to beginners for packing and how to pack in a pack and how it can be more than you think. So what are some of those best tips?
I think the biggest one for most people are shoes. Shoes take up a ton of space. As a guy, you know, most of my shoes are tennis shoes, which are bigger, always bigger than you think. You know, boots, things like that, where just one extra pair that you bring is going to eat up a ton of space. So if you're going on a trip where you do need multiple pairs of shoes, always say to wear the biggest and heaviest ones. And then, you know, you can pack, in my case, maybe I'd pack a pair of boat shoes, or a woman may pack a pair of flats or something like that. So whatever's small and you can pack that and wear the clunky ones, even if the weather while you're traveling isn't ideal for it.
Yeah,
and you kind of reshuffle when you get there.
Sure, I 100% agree. I actually just bought a pair of these work really well. A pair of like barefoot running shoes. Not that I like run very much as it is, but I bought them simply. They're a pack of Merrell barefoot running shoes, simply for the fact that they're, you know, you can basically scrunch them up. They don't have any weight to them, and they fit in really nice. And that instead of wearing like a pair of like, you know, I used to wear like Nike sneakers around and stuff, as if I needed a pair of sneakers. Now I wear these. I mean, they're probably at least half the weight. They take up at least less than half the size. And then I usually bring a pair of like loafers. So same thing, like for men, like leather loafers or a pair of boat shoes that are small. And I think, yeah, then wearing whatever is going to be the heaviest thing for you, depending on where you're going, is key.
Yeah. All the minimal tennis shoes. Now I'm realizing how giant and bulky my old ones are. You know, you realize how thick the soles and stuff are.
Yeah. And we're talking as two guys here. So maybe we're not the most fashionable or things like that, but I will have listeners know that my wife, who is a fashion blogger and a fashion expert, actually we've weaned her down slowly from, you know, the two check bags, wheeling them all over the place, to now she actually packs on a carry-on for every trip that we take, whether it be going to Spain. Last February we were in northern Spain where it was, you know, really cold, 30-40 degrees Fahrenheit. Down in the southern Spain it was like 60-65, so two different types of clothes there. And she loves her shoes, and she's been able to figure out a way. Like you said, Fred, she wears like the nice leather high boots that she's going to have on the trip. She wears them on the airplane, even if it's kind of not really appropriate for where we're leaving out of, and then packs other stuff. So it definitely can be done.
Hey, if a fashion blogger can do it, and I'm sure she still looks great doing it, then I think anyone can.
Yeah, she looks way better than me. There are a few times I will say that I have to shove a few extra things in my pack. You know, like she might be going over the limit a tiny bit, but I mean, she's gotten it down, and I'm actually excited. I think I'm going to shoot a video with her packing as well, because it is easier, usually, I would assume, maybe you could speak to this, for guys than girls, just because for us, we don't care as much most of the time.
Yeah, I think that's it. And there's also, guys' clothing tends to be simpler. You know, you have one or two pairs of pants, maybe a pair of jeans and something else, and then you're basically rotating through some t-shirts or button downs that are all pack up pretty small.
Right. That being said, I will say, and this is the limit of my fashion knowledge, but she, you know, she can pack those sundresses and they're like, you know, cotton or whatever. They basically are invisible in her pack. So girls, there are a lot of ways they can save on packing room as well. And I think it just comes down to, you made a great point earlier of just saying you're going to do it, and maybe you need to buy a new thing of luggage, because, you know, one of the things that we haven't touched on yet, but I find the bigger the bag I have, the more room I have, the more I just keep packing. I'll put in all my necessary stuff and say, oh, well, why don't I throw in an extra sweater or an extra shirt, because I have room if it's bigger than a carry-on, you know, if I'm packing something bigger. And all of a sudden, now I'm lugging around a backpack that's like 20 pounds when it could have been, you know, 12 pounds.
Exactly. Sometimes constraints are good. You know, they force you to work within those confines. I just went down to LA for a few days. We were shooting a video, and I packed up my Tortuga, and it was just a 3-day trip, so I hardly had anything in there. And then I was like, well, what else should I bring? I have all this space left over. So I started throwing in a jacket and stuff. I mean, just crazy stuff. Why would I need that?
Yeah, I'm with you. I've done it. As much as we preach this idea of a carry-on and, you know, packing as little as you can, I think everyone falls into that, because, you know, if you have the room, you just do it. So if you set yourself to the constraints of, you know, this is a carry-on size, you know, it kind of, you figure out as you're packing what you need and what you don't. You know, you look at that sweater that you haven't worn in 5 months and you say, well, I don't need this. So I think that the constraints are good. So let's say, all right, now we've convinced people, right? We've convinced them that they should travel with just a carry-on. They're ready to give it a go. You know, all their fears and excuses are vanquished. What are things that people should look at then when they're picking out the right backpack? And you already talked about the shape of it, but what are some other things that people need to know about a backpack? Because a lot of people haven't bought backpacks. They usually buy the rolled luggage.
Yeah, so a few things that we were kind of looking for in bags on this trip that spawned the Tortuga and that I've kind of figured out are pretty important since. So the biggest, like we've been talking about, is being carry-on sized. Obviously, that's important for saving money, all the reasons that we've already run through. The next thing that for us we thought was really important was a shortcoming of the existing backpacks, was because most of them are made for hiking, they're not really very well organized. You know, they load from the top. It's basically like packing a garbage bag. So if you want something in the bottom, you have to take everything out, get your thing, put everything back in. That was the problem of the bag that I bought for this trip to Eastern Europe that I talked about. It was a Go-Lite bag, perfectly good quality bag, but, you know, was made for hiking. So what we saw as an opportunity and ended up doing is creating a bag that's front loading. And we're definitely not the only one out there. There are plenty of others, but it's called either front loading or clamshell style opening, but basically means that the whole front of the bag will open just like how you would open a suitcase,
right,
as opposed to a little spot at the top, like most hiking bags open.
Yeah, I think that's invaluable. When I first bought my first backpack, that was the thing that I first learned was, you know, people were talking about these hiking backpacks with the top loading ones. And, you know, everyone said, well, that's great for hiking. Like if you're climbing Mount Everest, go with that, right? You're not going to be unpacking your stuff all the time. But if it, for a travel backpack, yeah, the front loading ones are great because it opens up like a suitcase. You can get all your stuff. It, you know, it sits in there. You can see it all. What are other things then? So, you know, you go with a front loading backpack. What are some other concerns that people should, you know, have when looking for the right pack?
Yeah, I would say those are kind of the two biggest ones. And the next really big one is making sure that it's comfortable. Again, it's not a hiking bag, so you won't have it on for 10 or 20 miles or something like that, but you want to make sure that it fits you well and it feels comfortable. So, if you're checking it out in a store or if you order something and you're giving it a go at home before going on a trip, make sure you actually load it up. And if you go to a store like REI or any of the outdoor stores, they'll have even little weights they can give you to put in the bag so that you can walk around with it full. Obviously, everything feels good when it's empty. You know, right. Probably weighs 2 or 3 pounds, yeah. So that's fine. But actually load it up. Put, you know, 20 pounds or so is usually, think about 22 pounds is kind of a common limit. So, you know, put 20, 25 pounds in it, since you're probably going to overload it, and walk around with that. Make sure it's still comfortable. Sometimes you do see a lot of bags that look great and then they'll skimp a bit on the straps. So, you know, make sure that it's still comfortable, whether they're thick or thin straps.
Yeah, and I've noticed that with the Tortuga backpack that I just got last week, and I haven't taken it on. I took it on a mini trip this weekend to give it a trial run, but the straps are they're very padded. They're very thick. The straps that go over your shoulders, as well as the waistband, which is a lot different from many of the carry-on size packs. You know, the bigger packs that are the ones for hiking and the bigger backpacks usually have better padding because they're, you know, 70-liter packs and all. But a lot of the carry-on ones, like you mentioned, have just regular backpack straps. And you know, if you are going to be putting some luggage in there, even if you're not going to walk 15, 20 miles, but you're usually, if you're walking around town and stuff like that, yeah, you know, you might walk a mile or two with your pack from the train to the hotel or train to the hostel, what have you. And that adds up you get used to this idea of like, all right, this is kind of heavy. So if it's not comfortable, it definitely is a detriment.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have a really streamlined bag that I use kind of day to day just to carry my laptop around. And even that one, you know, the straps are perfectly fine. They're not super padded or anything, pretty average for that kind of bag. But even if I'm carrying my laptop around for too long during the day, I'll start to feel it a little bit in my shoulders. So, you know, that's just a couple pound MacBook. So imagine that plus 20 pounds of clothes.
Right, right. Yeah. And that's great. And yeah, so you want to look at the shape, like you said, that rectilinear shape. You definitely want to look at the straps and you want to make sure that it is carry-on size. And you can find the dimensions for carry-on size. If it is carry-on size, it's probably going to make a pretty big point of it because, you know, it's a selling point. So make sure you try them out, like Fred said. Let's flip this around a little bit because now I want to talk about the entrepreneurship side of Tortuga and how you started it, because it's going to be invaluable to people who want to start a company. And a lot of people want to start a company, myself included. You know, you go the digital route, and now I've started a website, I have a podcast, I'm able to make a full-time job out of that, and it's great, and there's nothing wrong with digital products and, you know, selling someone else's stuff and that kind of deal with the internet. But you've actually created a physical product, so you've jumped through a lot more hurdles than a lot of other people have, and I think many people have an idea for a physical product and don't do it because they just think, well, I don't even know where to start. And I think that it actually is the hardest part, actually getting something started. So if you wouldn't mind kind of talking about what was the push that took this from an idea? You talked about, all right, there's not a backpack that exists that we like, but why did you then actually go and make the pack? Because we all have ideas, but actually implementing it and building your first backpack. Walk us through those steps and how you kept going until you actually had a product.
I would say that we did it because we didn't know any better, that we couldn't.
Ignorance is bliss, for sure.
Exactly. So it was kind of two things came together. So had this trip where we recognized this problem and, you know, wanted a better solution. And also right before that, Jeremy and I had both read The 4-Hour Workweek, which I think is the genesis of so many people who have started companies in the last, whatever, 5 years or so since it's come out. So having read that, you know, we were kind of looking for ideas. We loved the sound of it, wanted to do something in that vein, and then had this issue where we couldn't find the right backpack. So those two things kind of came together, and it was a combination of having that book, which we thought would give us enough of a framework to work from. You know, so much of this stuff feels like, you know, you have an idea and then what the heck do you possibly do? There's 100,000 steps between that and having a business, you know? Right. So with that book, it felt like there was at least some rough guidelines we could kind of follow.
You had a fighting chance, right?
Exactly. So if we could follow that, we could at least, you know, roughly find the path and then make our way from there. And then the other thing, like I said, was just being a little bit naive or ignorant is sometimes good. You know, by the time we were far enough in to realize how hard what we were doing was, we were already so committed that, you know, we didn't want to go back. So sometimes it's good, you know, people want to overanalyze things before they jump into it. And obviously you want to do your research, but sometimes it's also really good to just kind of jump in and get far enough along, figure out if you care about this thing. And then once you hit those hurdles, you know, you don't want to go back and you're already so invested that you're just going to figure out a way to get over them, even if it takes 10 jumps.
Yeah. What about, I think that's great advice. What about the idea of money then? Like, let's talk about someone who doesn't have a lot of money to invest in the beginning. And I think most, you know, if it's your first go at it, most people are going to be in that situation. I'm sure you and your co-founder were in that situation. So it's good to be invested in the thing and try to just go for it. How were you able to do that on a limited budget? And then do you think, you know, kind of talk about putting the money in, did that keep you going? You know, was that a reason like, all right, we've invested this, we have to keep going? Or how did that play out?
It becomes tricky with money. You know, there's a concept in economics called sunk costs. So whenever you're making a decision, even if you've spent whatever thousands and thousands of dollars up to that point, you can't base it on what you've already done. You have to base it on kind of what's coming next. So that does tend to be hard, you know, when you've put some money in to be willing to close something down if you have to. But for us, the investment tended to be more emotional. You know, we cared about the product and we wanted something to exist at that point. But yeah, the money aspect is very hard, especially with physical products. There's definitely more startup costs, of course. But even since, so we had the idea in 2009 and I think really kind of got moving in around 2010 on it. Even since then, a lot of the things we did, you can do much cheaper now. So, you know, we wasted some money on getting a custom theme built for Shopify, which is the software behind the store, kind of an e-commerce platform. We wasted money building a custom theme there, and it looked okay and was fine. And then when we just relaunched the site a couple months ago, they now have a theme store, and we bought a new one for $140, and it looks 140 times better.
Okay.
You know, some of these costs kind of come down over time, but it's a matter of making sure you kind of know what you're getting into. The biggest advantage now with physical products is that you can do a Kickstarter. So that can help finance a lot of the initial investment as far as an order from a factory. So you kind of just need to be able to account for the process up to then, which isn't necessarily cheap. There's, you know, in our case, there's sampling, testing, making prototypes. We worked with a design firm to design the initial version of the bag. So, you know, you can kind of, one thing that'll help, you know, just plead poverty. Tell people that, you know, you're a new business, you're just getting started. The first designer we worked with actually, I mean, he's designed soft goods stuff for huge companies and worked with, you know, really big name brands, but he also just liked working with small businesses and helping create a new thing. So sometimes you just need to find people that believe in what you're doing and, you know, sometimes we'll give you a little break and hopefully you can give them some more business in the future when you have a better budget for it.
Yeah, that's a great point. Now, for you guys, was there ever a desire, because I don't think, maybe you can, I'll ask you a question first. Did you find investors to help you defray some of that startup cost, or was it all your own money?
No investors.
Okay.
All our own. And we actually ended up, we got a little bit lucky. We worked with, we did get some money from an organization called the Jewish Free Loan Association. The one we worked with was in LA, but I think they have chapters in a bunch of places, but they actually do small interest-free loans. Okay. I don't know how or why they're generous, but yeah, we ended up getting a little bit of money from them, which helped with some of those initial kind of setup and startup costs. And then from there, tried to get the first order out, even if it was small, and then, you know, could kind of roll over some of that money into growing the business.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of stuff out there like that, whether it's an interest-free loan like you talked about, and some of that just comes from digging. I don't know if there's a really good resource out there that tells you, you know, all the competitions or loans you can get, because I know, just for example, with the app that I'm trying to build with Bolt, it, you know, I entered a competition to win $50,000 in startup, and you know, if I end up winning that competition in January, there's $50,000 I have to start a company. And, you know, I didn't have to do anything other than put in my time, my idea, create basically from scratch this idea. And then all of a sudden you have some money to play with. So I would urge people, and I'm sure you would say the same, just look at the options. There is more out there. You know, Pepsi does a thing with giving out money to small businesses. There's a lot of companies that do that because they want to fuel entrepreneurship, and they also want it to look very good for PR for them. And there's a lot of stuff out there.
Can look at, you know, whatever industry you're in, there'll be some competitions and grants and loans and things like that. We weren't successful, but tried to go back to like our college and things like that. Sometimes they have stuff for alumni. So just think of any networks you're maybe already a part of or trying to be a part of, and sometimes there's some money available there.
Yeah, and it's a great point, because a lot of us don't know where to start. You think, well, even if it won't be a lot, if you're like, I need $5,000 or $10,000 to start it, you know, many people don't have that to invest in something that's, you know, at that point a side project. So yeah, try to pick where you can find some money, and I don't do a good enough job at it. I know most people don't, because they don't know where to look, but if you're willing to do the research, if you really believe in your product, which most people listening probably do, I think putting a little bit of time there can pay off huge rewards later, because it helps you get started. And once you're started, like you said, the ball's rolling. You've invested the time, you've invested maybe some money and the sweat equity. And then you're like, well, we have to make this work because we've put so much into it. And usually you end up making it work.
I think as a side project is also pretty big. You know, it eases a lot of the financial pressure on the business. You know, you still have an income coming in. Hopefully you can save a little bit of that or put it towards the business. And there isn't a sudden pressure to go from an idea to a full-time income.
Yeah, I know I did that with my site. I worked full-time for the first 9 months until like kind of a natural breaking off point. And I was able to take the money that I was making and live off, you know, that from my regular job. And I didn't have to make any money with my site at all. And I know you guys do that at Tortuga as well, where you keep the jobs and so that you could build Tortuga, and the pressure isn't there. So that's a really good point. What were some of the biggest obstacles then along the way? How did you overcome them? You know, things either with manufacturing the actual product or emotional or mental obstacles, anything that came up for you?
Yeah, so what we've already discussed were some of them, but in our case, it was the manufacturing piece was very hard. You know, you're starting to see a little bit more press around manufacturing coming back to the U.S. and companies like Maker's Row making things a little bit easier for people that are trying to get stuff manufactured. But even when we were starting out, we found it to be pretty difficult. You know, we're typically going through someone's recommendation or trying to search on, there's a site called Alibaba, which is for companies in China, manufacturers in China. But, you know, it's all very much a black box, and it's hard to make that connection online when it's someone that is on the other side of the world and you're going to be sending thousands of dollars to. You know, a website doesn't quite make it as far as that connection goes.
Yeah.
So the manufacturing has always been a difficult piece for us. With the first run, we actually after some trial and error in with a Chinese factory through a designer, we ended up making the first run in the U.S. So we knew we weren't really going to make any money on those bags, but the advantage was that they were willing to do a very small run, so we could actually afford to make something to at least get it out there.
How many did you produce that first run?
First one was only 100.
Okay.
Which, you know, we were lucky to be able to do that in the States, and you certainly couldn't have done anything that small in Asia. So that ended up being kind of our trial run. And it was also nice because that was in Southern California, so we could go there frequently, work with them. They turned out not to be very good to work with, but at least it got done and we got them out there. And, you know, that was kind of our first big goal, was to just ship it so that we could get it out there, get people's feedback, see if this was roughly something that people wanted, and then change it based on, you know, what the feedback that we heard.
How did you go about then marketing those first 100 bags? Because that, I mean, it's a small amount overall, but it actually, I mean, but that's, if you can sell 100 bags, you know, everyone says if you can do 100 of this, then you can do 1,000 of it, then you can do 10,000. So how did you get the word out there for the first 100 bags? Because that's pretty impressive to me, actually.
Yeah, we tried a little bit of everything. I have kind of a marketing background, so that was something I was really excited for and kind of sunk my teeth into. The biggest stuff for us were a lot of, I would say, content in general. So some of that was stuff we were producing. So we've got a blog that we've been writing for a while, and that's brought us a lot of people that have started reading the blog, gotten interested there, you know, maybe liked some of the tips or liked what we were about and thinking about, and then ended up buying bags. And then also similar stuff, but not on our site. So we've had some sites do reviews. We had a review on Matador Network, which is a big budget travel site, on Vagablogging, which is Rolf Potts' site,
right.
A couple of places, and also in the similar vein with that, press mentioned. So one of our first couple days, we were on Thrillist, which is a daily email in a bunch of different cities with kind of cool stuff for guys. They've kind of since changed, but it used to be very product focused. So we were in one of their emails, and I think that was in the first week, and just that email sold like 6 or 7 bags in the first week, which, you know, a small number, but when we were starting out, it was pretty great. If I could do cartwheels, I would have been doing them.
Right, right. Yeah. And how did you, to touch on that, how did you get those press mentions? Because again, you know, some people, you know, they're scared they're going to do something. The big fear, I think, of most entrepreneurs, I'm going to do something and no one's going to know. So what type of things did you do to get on Thrillist, or just in general to get these media mentions?
Yeah, for these, I just tried to be really genuine and, you know, do the contacting and building those relationships myself. I know I've seen a lot of people either with funding or people that have gone through Kickstarter and stuff and hire PR firms, which, you know, is fine. And I think they're really strong with getting in some of the bigger magazines and big name publications. But, you know, with a lot of the smaller websites and stuff, I think it really helps to be genuine and be like, hey, I had this problem. I made this solution. Like, if you think this is interesting, hey, I'll send you one. And, you know, would love to see a write-up about it. Or, you know, if you think this is interesting, could you cover us and include us in your next email or whatever? I think just being pretty honest and transparent and making sure that's coming from you and coming from the source is what really matters. And then, you know, some people they're not going to be into it. Some people love suitcases or whatever, you know, and that's fine. If they wrote about it, it would probably be, you know, negative or not great anyway, right? So you just want to find those people that can be kind of your champions and evangelists outside of the company that like what you're doing.
I could not agree more with that. I think that nowadays there's so much stuff with internet marketing, and here's how to do it, and here's how to optimize it. And all of it is great tips, but I think that the best thing you can do, and this is how I've built Extra Pack of Peanuts and how I continue to build it, is just being genuine, being open, and really making those connections one-on-one. Like, you sent me an email. We've been talking a little bit. You know, we have a connection. I know you as the founder of Tortuga Backpacks. You know me as the founder of Extra Pack of Peanuts. And you really just build a genuine connection with people who want the same thing as you. And I think that there's nothing that you can do with internet marketing that is going to be as beneficial in the long run as that.
Yeah, some of that, you know, it is kind of a longer game. But, you know, if you're committed to your product and you intend to be around for a while, then that's okay. That stuff right. will pay off. You know, the people that like what you're doing will, you know, maybe they write an article, maybe they don't, but they mention it to a couple friends and, you know, you start kind of growing organically that way.
Yeah, I can't agree more. I think that kind of builds into this next idea. Many of the people who are not entrepreneurs, they kind of go at their project alone because they're scared to ask for help, or they don't think anyone knows what they're doing or anyone can help them, or they don't have friends who have done it. I know for me personally, you know, a lot of my friends in high school and college aren't online entrepreneurs. They're not entrepreneurial. They have regular jobs, which is fine. Some of them don't even travel. But, you know, so I've had to kind of figure out not to get rid of my old friends, but, you know, create a new circle of influence of people who can help me. And I think most of the time, inevitably, people try to do something on their own and they end up failing, because I believe that a strong support system to your business idea is paramount to its success. So I'm interested to hear if you turn to anyone for help and how you found those people to guide you and how others can do the same thing.
Yeah, sometimes it's actually nice to have, social pressure, right? If you tell people about what you're working on, then guess what? They'll probably ask about it next time they see you. And if you haven't made any progress, you're going to probably feel guilty and work a little harder for the next time you see them, right? So sometimes it's good to get that out there. But yeah, that's a good point. I was in, you know, a similar boat. I didn't know a lot of people who have done anything like this. So that has been kind of part of the reaching out that we just talked about a minute ago. You know, I would look at companies. So one example, Clothing Arts, who does, they make pickpocket proof clothing, mostly hemp.
I saw that the other day, actually. Okay.
Yeah, it's very cool, and you know, they're in a similar vein as us. You know, a small company in the travel space making a physical product, and I reached out to those guys and other companies like that occasionally, just with a question and being like, "Hey, I'm new. This is what we're doing. You know, just wanted to know XYZ." And most of the people in a similar position to you they're going to be pretty generous and pretty nice. You know, don't ask for hours of their time or ask vague open-ended questions. But if you hit a roadblock and you think there's someone that might be able to help you with it, you know, reach out to them. Adam, the guy behind Clothing Arts, has been super nice and really nice guy, really kind to me, and has always been helpful in answering stuff. So just make sure you don't put a big burden on people. But if you have a very pointed question, you know, you can reach out and people will help you out. The other thing I actually just started doing recently, so I have, you know, I live in San Francisco, so I have a lot of touch with the kind of startup and tech world. So know people there and now have met a lot of people in travel, and that's been great. But one thing I thought I was kind of missing was the e-commerce side. So I actually recently started a meetup group here in San Francisco for other e-commerce entrepreneurs, and have since met a lot of people that are in the same boat, you know, one or two people running a small store online. And, you know, some of them make their own products, some don't, but just another aspect of what we're doing and another way to meet people that can help you out.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, like you said, don't put too much pressure on the people that you ask for help. I think it starts with, I always tell people, you know, send an email that's five sentences or less. And people are like, there's no way I can do it. And I say, yeah, there is. Start with how you know them, what you like about what they do. Obviously, you want to compliment someone or say like, hey, that pickpocket proof clothing is awesome. That's a great idea. I'm doing the same thing. You know, introduce yourself very shortly and then ask your question, because you know, you don't want an email that's 10 paragraphs long because no one wants to answer that or read it. So that is invaluable. You know, just be very poignant, be very to the point about it. And I have found that 90% of times I ask people a question or want to get their feedback on something, they'll do it, because we're all in it together in the long run. If you're not reaching out to huge companies and you're reaching out to a person like we talked about before, usually it works very well.
Yeah, it's not a zero-sum game, right? They're not all rooting against you.
Right. Even
in your dark moments, maybe you think that, but it's not true. And, you know, the other thing I always try to do in those emails or in that kind of contact with people is ask them if there's any way I can ever help them, or tell them if something comes up, you know, these are the kind of things that I'm good at or have a background in. So if you're generous with your time, I think that'll get paid back to you.
Yeah, adding value to someone else never hurts. And it's recognized, because a lot of people just want advice and never will think about what they can do for the other person. So, you know, even if it's just something small, if you're really, if you're good at copywriting or you're good at any little thing, or maybe you look at their site and you say, hey, here's one thing I noticed, like a word was misspelled. You know, that's going to stick in their mind like, wow, he took the time to go through and actually do something for me, or he or she took the time to do it. And I think that's a big part of building a relationship. You can't just keep wanting. And I have found that other entrepreneurs are usually people who are champions, have that kind of champion personality. You know, if I find something that I like, I'm going to tell all the listeners that are listening, I'm going to tell everyone on my blog, because it's something that I enjoy, that I've used, and I want it to become successful. And I think a lot of other entrepreneurs in this space are that way too, because they value people who have put time and effort into a product and have a dream and want to see that succeed.
Definitely.
What is then the best advice you can give to an entrepreneur, wannabe entrepreneur, who hasn't yet pulled the trigger on their product, whether it's a physical product, digital product, anything that they want to do, really?
You know, as Nike said, just do it. I think, you know, Seth Godin is kind of a marketing guru, writes a very popular blog online, and he's always talking about ship it. Like, that is the most important thing. You know, you can do all the research, speculation. You know, you can come up with a million reasons why your thing isn't going to work, but if you get it out there and start sharing it with the right kind of people, then you'll find out what's either that it does work or what you need to change about it. So the basic thing is getting it out there. I mean, you can even look at us. In our case, we had a physical product, but our first version, because of all this jumping around with designers and factories, didn't really turn out how we originally designed it. Our first version was very ugly. It was a perfect square, and the logo was printed way too huge on it. You know, people said it looked like a billboard. We got plenty of negative feedback like that, but the most important thing was that we got it out there, and some people liked it. You know, the people that bought it actually really loved the bag, and you know, from there, we knew what we needed to change design-wise, but just from people using it, we got other feedback and smaller things that we wanted to tweak, and then we just relaunched the new version and have been doing really well. We had a lot of pre-sales, and then, you know, hopefully the holiday season will turn out well. So, you know, just putting something out there is the most important thing. And I forget where I read it first, but someone said that if you're not embarrassed by the first version of your product, you didn't put it out there soon enough.
So true. So true, Fred. The first thing I did, the Ultimate Guide to Frequent Flyer Miles, it's like, you know, an online electronic PDF book. And I think a big part of it is setting a date as well. I told everyone on my blog, this will be launched. I can't even remember the exact date, but let's say November 5th of last year. And that was it. As soon as I said November 5th at noon, I had to have something, right? Because people had said they wanted to pre-order it. You know, they had said, I'm interested, this and that. And I was up all the night before making the final revisions, doing everything, calling the designer in the Philippines, like, hey, this cover doesn't look good. And, you know, I put it out there. And now I look at it, I'm like, man, that is ugly. Like, that design is ugly. But people bought it, and the content is great. And I set a date and a time. And if I hadn't done it, I would have tweaked it forever. And the thing I think that's important with digital products, a little different for physical, is that you can always change it. I can go and change the cover right now and you know, put it out there. So I think getting it out there is real important.
Remember what the first cover was next week, right?
Right.
Go Google what the first version of Twitter and Facebook and stuff looked like. They weren't great.
Yeah, 100%. That's great. Just do it. At the end of the show, in a couple minutes, we're also, as Fred said, during the holidays, we're going to run a promotion for Tortuga Bags if you are interested. So stay on the podcast. We're going to give you that coupon code in a couple minutes. But this being a travel show, there's no way I'm going to let you go without us hearing a little bit about your travel likes and your habits. So where is one of your, what are your favorite places that you've been to? And also importantly, I love hearing this, everyone's answer this, where is the place that you've been to that maybe disappointed you a little bit, or you don't want to go back to right away?
Yeah, most of the places I've really loved have been because of the experiences that I've had there. So I have really fond memories of everywhere that we went on this backpacking trip that I mentioned earlier that eventually spawned the Tortuga. So a couple places I really liked on that trip were Prague and Budapest, which were just so different than anywhere I had been up to that point. You know, they felt like kind of taking a time machine back in time, and were also just really fun cities to wander around and eat and poke around in. Another favorite is Sydney, mostly because I was actually there on kind of a I used to work at Google and was pretty good about mooching off of travel opportunities there. And they had a program that was similar to study abroad, but work abroad for 3 months.
Very cool.
I got to study for 3 months on someone else's dime, which was great. And, you know, in that case, I was there long enough that felt like I lived there a little bit. You know, you got a really authentic experience and met a lot of people, got used to the neighborhoods, things like that. So that's always been a good one for me that I've really loved. As far as negatives, I haven't had too many bad experiences. There are some places that I don't think I would need to go back again, or based on what they're great for, I wouldn't go back. So on the Eastern Europe trip, the last stop, we went down to Croatia and spent a couple days on Var, which is basically kind of like a party island. It's sort of Ibiza light, which was very fun at the time, but now I don't think I could keep up with it, and I certainly to go back and do it again.
Very, very cool. Yeah, and like you, I've never had a really negative travel experience, but there are places that everyone's like, you have to go, you have to go, you have to go. And I brought up on the podcast before, but like Penang, Malaysia, for me, you know, whatever the situation, you know, it was raining and, yeah, it was the end of our trip and stuff like that. But it's always interesting to hear those sides of the story. And, I appreciate you sharing that with us. And I'm with you. Sydney's a great place. I didn't get to spend 3 months there. I was there for a couple weeks, but really cool city. Also, like me, you're someone who enjoys traveling as much as they can. I know that. And in order to do that, you know, you don't work at Google anymore, so you can't mooch off them too much. You have to save money in a variety of different ways so you can, you know, continue to travel more while spending less. So what are some of the best ways that you've learned to save money when traveling, to cut corners, still have the awesome experiences, but not waste extra money so that you have some left over when you want to go on another trip?
Yeah, I think I've started doing what I know you're a big fan of, which is collecting frequent flyer miles. The biggest way for me to do it so far has been through the credit card sign-up bonuses.
For sure.
I'm lucky enough that I can sign up for personal cards and also business ones, so I can really kind of pile up the points. I got one of the American Airlines City Card, I think.
Yep.
They were doing kind of a limited one for 100,000 points. So that's my biggest one to date. I don't know if I can top that in the future, but I will certainly try. But yeah, that's definitely a huge way to save. And even domestically, I'm a huge fan of Virgin America, and I've been able to get a lot of free flights through them, even though I don't have a card, just from flying. They have pretty good returns on miles.
Yeah.
So definitely would check those out. And then, you know, from there, just in general, I am a budget traveler. And, you know, I think a lot of people put so much pressure on a trip, especially people that don't travel a lot, that they have to splurge on every aspect of it. But really think about the things that you're going to enjoy the most and really remember. And that's where I try to spend my money. So I have no problem staying in a hostel or, you know, a less great hotel, because you're just going to be there to sleep. You know, read the reviews, make sure it's clean and everything. But that's a place where I don't want to splurge as much. I want to splurge on maybe a cool activity or experience in the city. Or the biggest one for me is eating. I love to eat. I love to try new foods in different places. So, you know, some places you can get away with cheap street food, and some places you may have to spend a little bit more. But, you know, that's kind of something that I really enjoy. And that's where I spend my money, and I go a little cheaper on other things.
Yeah, we're more alike than I even realized. I'm with you. You know, every time I have to pay for a hotel and it's, you know, or there's no other options, I sit there and I cringe, because I think, you know, I don't really care about this hotel. And, you know, I'm a big proponent of hostels, like you said, or cheaper hotels, Airbnb, renting apartments, stuff like that. But yeah, very, very good advice there. Last question for you then. When was the last time you checked a bag?
Oh, man. I think I may have checked some bags the last time that I moved, which was, I've been in San Francisco for about 6 years, but spent 1 year in LA during that period. So I think in my moving around, I checked a bag, but that was for moving my whole apartment.
Right. Yeah, you need like 8 Tortuga backpacks or more. And
from now on, I can't ever do that. What if someone sees me doing that? Then that picture up on the internet, and you know, it's all over.
Yeah, viral video of Fred checking bags at the airport.
I'll have to hire someone to check them for me or wear a mask or something.
Right. Fred, thanks so much for coming on the show. I love talking to someone who is enthusiastic as you are about your company, you know, about helping other people travel better, and also is on fire to help other entrepreneurs get out there and succeed like you are. Before I let you go, just remind people one more time how they can come and find you, how they can connect with you. And you even got a deal for Extra Pack of Peanuts listeners if they want to buy their own Tortuga backpack.
Yeah, you can check out the site and hear a little bit more about our story and check out the backpack itself at tortugabackpacks.com. That's TORTUGA backpacks.com. And yeah, like you mentioned, a little special deal for your listeners, since they've sat through so much of listening to me, that they can save $20 on a bag. Just use the code PEANUTS, PEANUTS, when you're checking out.
Awesome. And yeah, we're going to link all that in the show notes. So if you are listening to this and you forget it, you know, Tortuga is the Spanish word for turtle, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so that's how I remember it. But if you do forget or you forget the code, we're going to put it all in the show notes there for you. So, you know, come to the site. You can see it there. Yeah, use Peanuts. Fred, once again, thanks so much for coming on the show. My Tortuga just came in the mail last week. I said I gave it a little kind of test run there. I'm super excited to put it through the ringer and really test it out during my next trip to Italy in January.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to hearing your feedback.
Yeah, and thanks again, Fred. It's been great. Love the pack so far. Guys, if you want to check out Tortuga, go to tortugabackpacks.com. And again, that special promo code, $20 off. Very generous of Fred and his team over there. Just use Peanuts in the coupon code box and you'll get $20 off. Thanks again, Fred.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Guys, if you've been listening and you've been sick and tired of wheeling around those heavy, heavy bags or paying for those check bag fees at the airport, you heard Fred, you heard me. We're both big, big proponents of trying to travel with just a carry-on piece of luggage. My wife, a fashion blogger and fashion expert, has been able to do it. So I really, really would urge you to give it a try on your next trip. It's not as hard as you think. And if you are going to grab a carry-on bag, make sure you check out Tortuga Backpacks. They're the perfect size. They still fit a lot in there. And remember, Fred is graciously offering a $20 off coupon. Just make sure to use Peanuts, PEANUTS, when you go and check out there. And that's at tortugabackpacks.com. Don't forget, Extra Pack of Peanuts is also offering a special for their Ultimate Guide to Frequent Flyer Miles. You'll get a free 15-minute consultation directly with me to ask me any question you have about Frequent Flyer Miles or if you want help booking a trip. That'll all be for free if you purchase the business class or the first class version of that product up until Christmas. So we want to say thank you to you guys for really being loyal listeners and loyal fans of the website, and that's our way of saying thank you. Hopefully I'll get to talk to some of you guys on that free consultation right away. Head on over to extrapackofpeanuts.com/ultimate guide to take advantage of that offer. Thanks for tuning in, everyone, and until next time, happy free travels.